advertisement. Thank you. We'll go on to the second case of the day, and that is 14-16-18, Sarah versus ManWeb Services. Ms. Parisi.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rachel Parisi, appearing on behalf of appellants. We respectfully ask this court reverse the decision of the district court, which granted ManWeb judgment as a matter of law and denied the plan's motion for summary judgment below. This case presents the question of whether, in the narrow context of employer withdrawal liability, notice of a contingent liability satisfies successor liability's notice requirement. The plan argues that this question must be answered yes for two reasons. First, employer withdrawal liability is inherently different, and that difference demands different treatment in order to effectuate Congress's intent. Second, the equities here favor the plan and its participants rather than ManWeb.
I want to ask you this. Did the financial statements that Tiernan and Hoover disclosed during the due diligence review discuss actual withdrawal liability or just contributions to the plan?
Your Honor, somewhere in the middle there. On the record on appeal, pages 23 and 24, we have included those financial statements because they are very important to a finding of notice. Those statements indicated that Tiernan and Hoover was a contributing employer to a union-sponsored pension plan. It specified which statutes were at issue, specifically ERISA and the MPPAA. And importantly, it noted that Tiernan and Hoover, as a contributing employer, had a contingent withdrawal liability in the event of a withdrawal.
So did the words withdrawal liability appear anywhere in the financial statements?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
And that is where?
In the financial statements.
So that we'll see on 23 and 24 of the record?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, specifically, it indicates that they may be liable for the unfunded vested liabilities allocable to the company upon withdrawal from the union or termination of the plan for which it may be contingently liable. And again, it also includes the amount of contributions, the estimated contributions for each of the years at issue.
And one other question that I do have for you, which is, what is your best argument for the fact that notice can be of a contingent liability as opposed to an actual liability? And may I add that I think that you people that do this area of the law are geniuses.
I think I should conclude right there, Your Honor.
There's another genius here.
Well, Your Honor, there's a couple of different reasons where I think contingent liability is suitable and sufficient for the notice requirement under successor liability. And again, we're asking this to be held within the very narrow context of employer withdrawal liability. Employer withdrawal liability, it is inherently different. It is a known factor for those that are participating in defined benefit pension plans. In that respect, it differs from Title VII claims, FLSA claims, fringe benefit contribution claims. This is a concept that is out there. Employers are aware of it, and so forth. We know that under successor liability as an equitable doctrine, it is appropriate to use different contexts for different standards in order to attempt to effectuate the equitable purpose or goal of successor liability. And here, again, we believe that the difference being that it is a known concept to these defined benefit pension plan contributing employers, does warrant treatment as allowing for notice of a contingent liability to be sufficient.
So that language is sufficient that it may be contingently liable, but not ascertainable at the time is sufficient.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's honestly just one of the six different ways that we have found that ManWeb did have actual notice of the contingent liability. In addition to those financials, which in the plan's opinion on their own would satisfy the notice requirement, there were extended discussions between the primary decision makers, Charles Mandrell and Michael Webster at ManWeb, that included discussion of the unfunded pension liability. There are expressed references to employer withdrawal liability within the asset purchase agreement itself. There's no doubt or no dispute that ManWeb undertook due diligence and was satisfied with the due diligence in vetting the purchase pre-acquisition. There's also no dispute that ManWeb was aware of the relationship between Tiernan and Hoover as a contributing employer to IBEW 481 and its pension plan. And finally, case law indicates that we can use implied or inferred notice to satisfy that notice requirement, and we have that through the shared role of Michael Hoover at both Tiernan and Hoover and Manweb.
Well, in addition to notice, the artistic furniture case discusses a sufficient continuity requirement. Manweb did not use Tierman's plant, didn't use its machinery or equipment, didn't assume corporate identity, and didn't offer the same services. So how is the continuity requirement met?
Your Honor, the trial court did not address the continuity of operations in providing for summary judgment against the plan and judgment as a matter of law in favor of Manweb.
I know.
But nonetheless, we would argue that the continuity of operations is even more clear than the notice side. Although it did not hire all of the employees, it did hire 13 of 39 employees. It bought the goodwill. Most importantly, it bought the important Freegee name. And we had testimony from Mr. Webster. That was what they were going after, is that valuable Freegee name, which is still in use today. It's on their website. They send everybody to the website so that when they search the FreegeeCompany.com, they're going to be sent to the Manweb company. They had that industrial refrigeration specialty, which was a core of Freegee and was the work that was missing capability-wise at Manweb. So again, and I think that continuity of operations also weighs in favor of the equities that we're looking at here. This was not an accidental concept here that occurred, that they took over the operations. It was fully contemplated within the asset purchase agreement and did take place. So I think the argument that they had no notice that this would happen falters somewhat when you look at the context of that asset purchase agreement and how it did provide for the continuity of operations. Another very important fact that was left unaddressed by the district court is that Manweb did obtain indemnification. This circuit's case law is very clear, and the trial court even cited to the Masiki Wamba case, noting that the critical core underlying purpose of the notice requirement is, in fact, the opportunity to obtain indemnification. When you get down to brass tacks, we're doing all this arguing about the timing of the notice and so forth. Really, the question should be whether or not the goal of notice was obtained. And the goal, as set forth in the case law in this circuit, is very clear. It is to allow the opportunity to obtain indemnification, and Manweb did exactly that. We would ask simply that the court, when evaluating notice, do so not in a vacuum, but in the context of the purpose of notice in the first place, as well as the doctrines of employer withdrawal liability and successor liability in general. The district court's decision below has created a dangerous loophole. It ignores the policies underlying ERISA and the MPPAA. It invites signatory employers to cast off their withdrawal liability through a successor, allow the successor to come in and scoop up all the beneficial aspects of this predecessor, which were often gained through union labor, and leave behind that withdrawal liability to the plan's remaining employers. Just because Tiernan and Hoover stopped operations does not mean that withdrawal liability that's allocated to them vanishes. It's still an unfunded vested liability, and as a result, it has to be reallocated to the remaining plan employers. This is precisely the result that Congress intended to avoid in enacting the ERISA statutes and specifically the MPPAA. In reference to our second point, equities favoring the plan, successor liability, of course, is an equitable doctrine and has been read very broadly in this circuit. Even though successor liability is not referenced in ERISA's statutory framework, we think it's important to refer to the federal common law and then look at ERISA's underlying policy goals in applying this doctrine. Here, the equities favor the plan, and that is in accord with the congressional policy of protecting pension plans and their participants rather than Manweb, which was able to secure for itself every advantage, including indemnification, while leaving behind the withdrawal liability again to those remaining plan employers. This is not equitable and would not seem in line with the doctrine itself. We know through case law we're not to treat the doctrine of successor liability as an inflexible command, but rather to look at the specific facts. Here in particular, as I mentioned earlier, the facts make clear Manweb intended to continue these operations. This was not an accident that they now have become the Freegee Company or operating as the Freegee Company, making use of their good name, citing to their history on their website, and so forth. So those facts are critical to look at when we're evaluating this case. The district court improperly balanced the equities. At the outset, the district court undertook a detailed analysis of the withdrawal itself, and that was not within the trial court's purview, as that withdrawal had been conclusively established under statute. Congress intended exactly what the statute says, and that is that disputes that arise under 1381 through 1399 shall be resolved through arbitration. Here there was no arbitration. Chernin Hoover did not initiate arbitration, and as a result, the statute kicked in. We now have an amount that is made due and owing per statute, all affirmative defenses are waived, and the withdrawal is established. Despite that fact, the trial court undertook a detailed analysis of the withdrawal itself, and we would argue this was error. In addition, the court below used an inapplicable case in balancing the equities in favor of Manweb rather than the plan. The Richland Industries case predates the successor liability doctrine in this circuit by more than 10 years. In addition, it was a calculation of liabilities case rather than an imposition of liabilities case, which makes a significant difference. In addition, it was not a building and construction industry case, which this is before the court today. Finally, in applying that case, the district court did not acknowledge or recognize that Tiernan and Hoover's underlying withdrawal liability had already been established, again through operation of the statute and arbitration. At Manweb's brief at page 29, they cite to the district court and they make a statement which I think is very telling and very instructive in this case. They indicate that the building construction industry exemption rendered withdrawal liability prior to the closing a legal impossibility. This construct, again, which was adopted by the district court, is plainly inequitable. What it does, again, is puts us in that dangerous loophole where an entire industry, namely the building and construction industry, will be foreclosed from using the equitable doctrine of successor liability. That's simply not a result that must be allowed to stand. Barring from Judge Posner's reasoning in the recent Teed case last year in a successor liability case, the plan is not asking for a broad, expansive extension of the doctrine of successor liability, but merely asking that it be applied in such a way that building construction industry employers can be included within that doctrine. And again, the plan would respectfully ask that this court reverse the decision of the district court, and if there are no questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hansen, good morning.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court's decision in this case should be affirmed. Manweb is not a successor to prior owner, Tiernan and Hoover, the operations. And there's two reasons for that. One is Manweb did not have notice, actual or constructive notice, of an existing liability. As plaintiffs have admitted, there was not an existing liability. There was what they call a contingent claim. It's a hypothetical, unasserted.
So when
claim.
If the selling company flat out tells the buyer during negotiations, we owe $1 million to the multi-employer pension fund, you're saying the buyer is not liable because the withdrawal liability doesn't actually exist until the acquired company shuts down?
I think it has to be an asserted claim or notice of an existing an existing liability or notice of an existing claim of liability. And in the construction industry, this is especially important because a construction industry employer does not withdraw at the time that it ceases making contributions. There are two contingent events that must occur afterwards in order for a withdrawal to occur. If Congress was so interested in preventing this idea that unfunded liabilities and benefit funds, why did they create the construction industry exemption?
But
Congress said that the two contingents are it has to continue operations without making contributions, or it has to resume operations within 5 years.
Well, but under your theory of notice, that is that it has to be based on the successor's knowledge about the existing withdrawal liability of the seller at the time of purchase. Could a successor ever have notice of withdrawal liability? I mean, it can't know at the time of its asset purchase whether the selling company might resume its work within 5 years.
Right. And that's something where a buyer in a construction industry employer like we have with Tiernan and Hoover may never have actual notice or even constructive notice of a potential withdrawal.
But under your theory, it seems to me withdrawal liability doesn't exist
right.
until the plan demands payment from the withdrawn employer. And the withdrawal right. usually happens right at the time of purchase. So then a buyer okay. could never have notice about actual withdrawal liability, could it?
A withdrawal cannot occur for a construction industry employer at the time of sale. That
well,
is a,
then
that is
they
an
could,
impossibility.
Then
under
how
statute.
Could they ever have notice of withdrawal
they,
liability?
In my opinion, they could not ever have notice.
Ever?
In the construction industry because Congress created an exception. We may talk about, you know, we typically see it in the trucking industry, and you deal with a lot of central states pension fund cases. That's different. When a trucking company ceases making contributions at the time of a sale, it becomes immediately liable for the withdrawal liability. That would not be a question. But construction industry, Congress added two other elements that must be present, two other contingencies that must be present in order to create liability. And what the court, the district court did not review the withdrawal. What the district court said was, Manweb could not have anticipated at the time of the sale that Tiernan and Hoover would waive its objections to the withdrawal liability assessment because it wouldn't have had liability if it had contested it because it didn't resume operations. The 5 years hadn't passed, and it had not continued operations without making contributions. So in that situation, in the construction industry, it's very limited as to whether you may have a successor liability claim. It is unlike a typical withdrawal, a complete withdrawal, when a contributing employer ceases operations altogether and immediately triggers the withdrawal liability.
Look, so Manweb obtained indemnification from Tiernan and Hoover. Isn't Manweb's remedy against Tiernan and Hoover? I mean, I realize that the whole problem here is it isn't possible to collect from Tiernan and Hoover, but that was something that Manweb could have accounted for during the asset purchase negotiations, right? In other words, in a theoretical yeah. world, the plan would collect from Manweb, and Manweb would then use the indemnification clause to recover from Tiernan and Hoover.
And Tiernan and Hoover, at the time of the sale, would never, if it was going to permanently cease operations, would never have incurred a withdrawal because the two contingencies would not be met. It is not going to resume operations without making contributions, or it's not going to resume within the five-year period, and it did not continue operations without making contributions. That's the difference. Congress, if it had wanted to protect the plans, as the plaintiffs allege, would not have had the construction industry exemption. It would have simply said, hey, when you cease making contributions, you're liable. That's a different circumstance.
You know, tell me.
And
I'm sorry.
I just want to add one other thing,
sure.
Your Honor, if I might. Your question kind of assumes successorship. Successorship also includes that second element of continuity of operations.
Well, and what?
I'm sorry?
But Ms. Parisi maintains that happened here.
And that is absolutely incorrect and not supported by the factual record in this case.
So it wasn't use of the 3G company and the website and the phone number and making a referral and the logo and the letterhead? Those other things weren't there.
It bought assets, but that's not the test of continuity of operations under the law. You look at whether they use the same machinery and equipment. They did not. You look at whether they operate out of the same location. They did not. All of this is in the record. That's correct. It did not use the same employees to perform the bargaining unit work for which contributions were required. What she was talking about.
So that 13 that she referred to?
Were office employees. Office employees.
Does it matter?
Not. I believe it does because when you look at the successorship cases, there has never been a case where there has been successorship without the hiring of the bargaining unit employees. You can look at the Title VII cases. You can look at the NLRB case. You know, the board cases. You can look at ERISA cases. It always requires, and the cases that have found successorship find that there's been a continuity of the workforce. We didn't have that. You have to realize that ManWeb was a company that was anywhere from 3 to 5 times the size of Tiernan and Hoover. It simply finished the contracts, and it wanted the industrial refrigeration, which was one part of became one part of a much larger operation of ManWeb. But it was not a continuity of operations as we see under the law. The mere fact that there was we bought the name, which we didn't use for 2 years until ManWeb went through a corporate reorganization, the two owners split the business into two different operations. That occurred 2 years later.
Has the district court here created a new successor liability notice requirement that a successor must have had notice that its predecessor would fail to arbitrate a plan demand?
No. I think that what it did was apply the existing law to the circumstances of this case and found that there is no way that ManWeb at the time of the sale could have anticipated that when the assessment was finally issued many months, six to seven months later, that it could have anticipated that Tiernan and Hoover would not contest it, because if Tiernan and Hoover had, it would not have incurred a withdrawal.
So is it the law that the judge applied? Is that Richmond Industries? Is that what you're saying? That was
proper, yes.
That 1985 case.
Right. There's been withdrawal. I mean, we're talking about withdrawal was enacted.
You do know it's a district court case.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But
and even though we were all district court judges, now we're appeals court judges. Oh.
We got demoted.
So in our case, the two elements necessary for successor have not been demonstrated. There's not notice of an existing liability. The liability didn't exist before. There wasn't notice of a claim. The cases of successorship talk about a claim that has not necessarily been liquidated, but at least it's been asserted that here's an amount that's owed in a lawsuit or whatever, but there is some kind of a demand that's been made that says there's a liability out there. That did not exist in this case. Then secondly...
Yeah, but once Tiernan and Hoover waived its right to arbitrate the issue, the fact of its withdrawal liability was established by operation of the statute. So would you agree that the district court erred by evaluating the merits of the determination that a withdrawal had occurred?
No, I don't believe so. That occurred 9 to 12 months later, almost a year later. It was 11 months when notice, they determined that Tiernan and Hoover got notice when the lawsuit was filed in August of 2010, which was almost a year after the sale.
Can I ask you this? Do you think it matters that ManWeb claims that neither it nor Tiernan and Hoover were even aware of the concept of withdrawal liability? I mean, weren't both parties represented by lawyers?
Yes, Your Honor, they were. In fact, I was involved in one of my partners did the sale and purchase agreement for ManWeb. The thing about withdrawal liability is, especially in the construction industry, is it doesn't exist unless the two contingencies occur after the cessation of contributions. The cessation of contributions. They have to continue operations without making payments, or they have to resume operations within 5 years. But that is something that in the construction industry, if a party's going out of business, they will never incur withdrawal liability as a construction industry employer. And the district court noted, as the parties agreed, that Tiernan and Hoover was a construction industry employer. The court correctly found, putting aside the waiver issue, The question is, what did Manweb know at the time of the sale? It did not know that there was any withdrawal liability because there was none asserted, and it didn't know of any existing claim of withdrawal liability because that was impossible to know whether those contingencies would occur in the future.
Well, what about the fact that Tiernan and Hoover could have determined its withdrawal liability at any time by requesting the information from the plan?
Doesn't that tilt
toward finding notice? Manweb's due diligence, if it was acquiring the union shop, shouldn't that have included an inquiry into the plan? Maybe.
If you were buying a trucking company that would incur withdrawal liability at the time of the sale, yes, because then it becomes due and owing. In the case of a construction industry employer, you don't know whether the pension fund is underfunded. Some construction industry employers may not be. Ms. Parisi talked about how we know that there's this unfunded liability. That's not the case with every plan. It depends on the plan. And you can make a request for an estimate, but it's only an estimate at the time that it's given. It is not a notice of an existing amount owed at the time of the sale. It's something prior to the sale, but it is not telling you what would be owed at that time.
So would you just discuss the rationale for why it's different in the construction industry versus trucking and other industries? You know, those two additional conditions you mentioned.
Congress, when it enacted the withdrawal liability, it said that a withdrawal occurs when there's a permanent cessation the employer permanently ceases to make contributions or its obligation to make contributions ceases. They added in the statute two additional things for construction industry employers. They said, we're not going to, and oftentimes it's because the employees go back to the hiring hall and work for a different employer. So the concern about continuing contributions to fund a construction industry employer is met because continued contributions are made for that employee in the future with a different employer. That's, in fact, what happened. The people that left Tiernan and Hoover went to the hiring hall, went back out to union employers. Some of them went to one of the employees that left, started his own company, and several of them went there. The pension fund didn't bother to pursue that employer that took over and did the same work with the same employees.
You can finish that answer.
So it was Congress that created that exception, and the idea was it was different than a typical multi-employer operation. It is where the employees have the ability to go to the hiring hall, go out to different employers. Contributions continue to be made for those employees in order to fund the pension fund so that there are not these huge liabilities, unlike in a trucking operation or something like that.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Parisi?
Three minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, in rebuttal, I just wanted to touch upon a few points raised by opposing counsel. Manweb is arguing that existing liability is required under case law to provide notice, and that's simply not what the case law says. We have notice, it indicates that there is a liability or a claim. Nowhere is it specifically foreclosed that notice of a contingent liability would not be acceptable. And as we stated earlier, we would ask simply that this court interpret the law as it stands today. We're not asking for an extension. We're merely asking that notice be evaluated within the context of the specific peculiarities of employer withdrawal liability.
So speak to this point that he makes about the distinction in the construction industry and these two other conditions.
Right. Well, I think counsel's argument ignores the purpose of the withdrawal liability exception for the building construction industry and tries to use that as a rationale for why the building construction industry should not be allowed the benefits of the equitable doctrine of successor liability. In the legislative history, the whole point behind 1383B and allowing these extra conditions is, as Mr. Hansen said, to allow for the instances where the work is not absorbed by the union employers. Our argument here would be that to allow the district court's construction to stand as it does today, we are defeating the purpose underlying the building construction industry exception in the first place, because we are not promoting the work of the union employers. We're allowing a successor to take the place as a non-union employer and absorb the funding and financials that would have otherwise been enjoyed by union employers, which again is the point behind the building and construction industry exception. Manweb also argues that withdrawal liability does not exist prior to the withdrawal, and I think that is a misstatement. I think it is confusing and a little misleading to conflate the ideas of withdrawal liability and a withdrawal. That withdrawal liability does exist prior to a withdrawal. We know that because under Section 1021L, you're allowed to obtain an estimate. It does exist. It simply is not assessed until the withdrawal actually occurs. So I think those are two very important distinctions. And again, we would point out to the fact that indemnification was obtained. That, again, is the key to the notice requirement. And here, that was obtained by Manweb. If there are no further questions, that concludes our argument.
Okay, thank you so very much to both parties. Truly terrific briefs.